Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. And on this week, we of course have This Week in Music History. Another great episode brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. And of course, to help me along with this journey is my co-host, Jacob Crum.
Straight from Louisiana.
You weren't from Louisiana.
No, I'm not. I'm from St. Louis.
I was going to say. It's like, because I know. I would have known if you were from Louisiana.
Well, of course you would.
You probably could pass for somebody in Louisiana if you were down there.
Because I know your family. I know your extended family. They taught me everything I needed to know to survive in Louisiana.
Because I got family in Louisiana. And I told them back when I was down there last time, I was like, it is super hot.
Yes.
And super evil down there.
I don't know about that, but
This place is too hot and too evil for my taste.
I love Canal Street, man.
Oh, yeah. Canal Street is quite gorgeous. So,
the Park District down there.
Yes, yes.
That trolley ride?
Oh, yeah. I've done the trolley ride. Man. Rode it down, rode it back. Mm-hmm. And it's still the old trolleys and everything.
Yeah.
But either way, if you get a chance to go to Louisiana and enjoy some music, you know, there you go. You've got our recommendation to do that. It is actually a fantastic city for that. And, of course, you've got to go check out Preservation Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, one of the greatest jazz experiences anybody could ever go to. Just amazing stuff there.
The great thing about New Orleans is that even the tourist traps are worth going to.
That is true.
Like, the French Quarter, it's still a good time down there.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, like, okay, there is Bourbon Street. Everybody knows Bourbon Street. You know, but just off of Bourbon Street, they've got all of these other places that you can go. Really great restaurants, really cool little shops and stuff like that. It's like everybody knows Bourbon Street because it's all, you know, just messed up. But it's basically a bunch of bars and strip clubs.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's amazing. So
even inside of that, it's amazing.
Well, for you.
It's
not so much for me, but yeah, no, either way, let's get on with this show, because we do have some great music history to get to. But before we do that, of course, say if you want to help out the show, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. You can go to our group, our Facebook group, Follow the Sound, and search for that. It's we're constantly posting stuff on there, and we want other people to share their music as well with us. Post your videos, post, you know, thoughts about whatever bands happen to be going on in your head. But you can also help out the show if you go to followthesoundpodcast.com. You can click on the Amazon banner, takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping. We get a little bit of money back for anything that you buy. Any purchase that you make on the website, we get a little bit of money back, which is great. And, of course, we can also do you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Takes you to the exact same place.
Yeah, pass us a silver dime or a solid quarter one of these days. Why don't you?
So, but yes, I do see the numbers that come in on how much money comes from Amazon, and we are doing okay. You know, but a little bit more money would always help out, you know, for what we are trying to do. And we've got some very exciting things coming in the future, actually, for Follow the Sound. We will let you know about them as they come up. But we're going to get to music history because that's just what we're going to do. Oh, also, I completely forgot. If you happen to do find us on social media, invite your friends. It's an open group. You can all join in and we can all have a good time talking about music and enjoying the thing that we love, which is music. So music history, though, this week in music history, we're doing July 31st through August 4th, which is, you know, a good little chunk of days here. Now, I'm going to tell you this. Jake, you picked some very, very good notes this week.
And
I am excited to hear about them. So let's start off with July 31st. You got one that's older than what we normally do.
Yes.
What do we got?
1846. The French army adopts a new instrument invented by Adolf Sax. Can you guess what it is?
It's the flugelhorn.
No, it's the saxophone.
Never would have guessed that.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking the like a fossil horn, which he also invented. That is not how you pronounce it, but that's as close as I'm going to get.
You know, it's
because I'm not Belgian.
I never honestly thought that the saxophone was named after somebody.
Yeah,
you
know,
it was just like, oh, somebody named it something, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Because like, you don't think that somebody named oboe, like named the oboe. It's like, what is that? That's a flute. It was invented by Gustavo Flute.
You're right. But Mr. Sax was a clarinet player, and he desired a woodwind.
That was his stage name, Mr. Sax.
Mr. Sax. great stage name. that he wanted a woodwind that could keep up with the new brass sections, with the trumpets and the trombones and the other one.
French horn?
French horn. No, what's the smaller trumpet? The bigger trumpet.
Cornet?
Yeah, cornet.
All right.
And so to do that, he basically based this instrument on a brass clarinet.
Which makes sense,
which makes sense. However, he also designed it from the ground up to be overblown just like a clarinet. However, a clarinet, when you overblow it, it pitches up by a 12th,
mm-hmm.
right? So all your fingerings change for all the notes. So he designed the saxophone to pitch up a full octave so you wouldn't have to change your patterns.
Yeah, makes sense.
So there you go.
You know, saxophone was my first instrument that I learned in school.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I did a year of saxophone before switching to percussion, mm-hmm. and then I never looked back.
Okay.
Because I'm a drummer at heart, not a saxophone player.
I still have dreams of going back to the trombone, but I'm never going to pull the trigger on that. Like, that's like a whole other social group to, like, you know, get in with. And I don't need to go and, like, prove myself to anybody. So, because that's how jazz players are, you know?
Speaking of jazz players, though, what do we got next?
Ooh, 1918, jazzist. Don't know if that's a word. I might have just coined it.
I don't think it's wrong.
You know, I think it's fitting. It should be. Hank Jones was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi. In addition to being an early jazz recording artist, he was also the pianist that accompanied Marilyn Monroe when she sang Happy Birthday to the Mr. President.
Oh, yeah.
JFK, yeah.
Nice.
So if you listen to that, the recording of it is pretty, like, well, it's piss poor, really.
Oh, yeah, it's really bad.
Yeah, but you can hear that she's singing the song Improv, and he's playing improv to back her up and accompany it.
Yes.
So he's literally just holding on notes and making things up before he skips on to the next bar. And until I read this, that he was a guy that played it, I never paid any attention to it because it sounds so bad. But
yeah.
I went back and listened to it just here in the studio, and it's pretty good.
Yeah. So here's the thing that I know about Marilyn Monroe doing the Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
Yeah.
Is that when anybody does a version of it nowadays, mm-hmm. they aren't doing an impersonation of Marilyn Monroe.
Okay.
They are doing an impersonation of Mike Myers.
Doing Marilyn Monroe. Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Like, because he did it in Wayne's World 1, mm-hmm. that's the way that everybody else does
it
now.
Right. Like how nobody does William Shatner, they do Kevin Pollak doing William Shatner.
Nobody does George W. Bush, they do Will Ferrell doing George W. Bush.
Yeah.
So there you go. I like that, though. I'm always fascinated by people who can do actual, like, really good impressions, but, you know, it's harder to do. Let's see here. I'll take the next one just
because. Go for it, man.
So 1977, you're going to have to help me out with this, too.
Yes.
But the Starland Vocal Band show debuts on CBS. Put together as a summer replacement show, it failed to draw advertisers and was not renewed. The mostly forgotten show did give America its first glimpse of David Letterman, who was a staff writer and on camera actor who appeared in sketches. However, having their own show was not enough to overshadow Afternoon Delight, and the group is now mostly regarded as a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
Because of the song Afternoon Delight?
Yes.
See, I never knew the
origin
of it. Can
you name another? First off, could you have named the Starland Vocal Band?
No. No.
Okay.
Never would have known that.
Delight, yeah.
So that and the only other thing, I mean, and nowadays in the current generation, mm-hmm. the only reason they would know the song Afternoon Delight would probably be due to Anchorman.
Oh, I was going to say Arrested Development because that was like a whole plot, like a plot line.
No,
on
I
the
don't.
Song.
Okay. Well, I know that one. And then what was it on Glee? They did Afternoon Delight as well, which was another fun one because they had no idea that the song was about, you know, a nooner.
Right. But yeah, it was a variety show.
Yes.
That had David Letterman on it. So
yes.
That kind of had, he soaked his ties there in CBS before moving to NBC for the late night gig and then eventually came back.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Let's move on. 1982, though, a good year.
Okay. Yeah, I'll agree.
For us.
Okay.
Because we were born in that year. Survivor's Eye of the Tiger was number one on the U.S. album chart, which is great. The song was actually commissioned by Sylvester Stallone for the theme of Rocky III, my favorite Rocky movie.
I think that's everyone's favorite Rocky movie.
Because it's got frickin' Ivan Drago.
Right.
Yeah. Wait, no. No, I'm wrong. I am very wrong. Rocky III is not Ivan Drago.
No, Rocky III is...
Mr. T.
Yeah, Clubber Lang.
Clubber Lang. There you go. Forgot about that, because I was thinking about that, because then I was playing the theme song of Rocky IV in my head, and it wasn't Eye of the Tiger. So, I'm sorry, folks. My fault. I got it wrong. But yeah, it actually, it received an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Song and went on to sell over 5 million copies. And I've played this song. Yes. I've had to play this song like live.
Oh, yeah.
And it cracks me up every time I play it. Cause it's actually a fun song to play on drums.
Okay.
It just is. It's like, cause it's got all these like other more complex hits that, you know, most people don't think about. So, but it's got this really great driving beat to it. So I had to sing it for, or not sing it. I had to play it for a 5K run, like rock run or something like that, where they play rock music. Well, yeah, it was so stupid, but we did it anyway. All right. You can take the next one.
All right. 2004. It's Mac Davis Day in Lubbock, Texas. Mac Davis, of course, was a country artist and a songwriter. He's best known for writing A Little Less Conversation and In the Ghetto.
A Little Less Conversation, a little more action.
That great song.
You know what's funny is that actually In the Ghetto is sung constantly in my office.
Really?
Yeah, because somebody will be like, you know, it's like, man, that was crazy. And then for some reason, somebody goes, In the Ghetto.
Well, did you know that originally that song was pitched to Sammy Davis Jr.?
In the Ghetto.
Yes.
So that's how it's used in my office.
Well, Mac Davis went down to studio with guitar in hand and played the song for him. Also in attendance, oddly enough, Reverend Jesse Jackson.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Yeah. So can you imagine going down and pitching the song In the Ghetto and sitting down and singing it in front of Jesse Jackson?
No.
You. I want you to imagine you doing that.
No, I definitely wouldn't do that.
Well, supposedly, according to Mac, Sammy Davis told him right after the song, he said, I don't know whether to hit you or thank you, man. And eventually he turned the sound on and went to Elvis.
Yes, and Elvis turned it into a huge hit. Another thing is that Lubbock, Texas was actually the hometown of Buddy Holly. So there you go. They had a couple of famous people coming from there. That's
Butch Hancock as well.
Really?
Yeah, from the Flatlanders.
Nice. I watched this video on YouTube that was all about Lubbock, Texas, and who actually controlled it, like throughout the years. And it was a fascinating little history going back like 20,000 years or something.
Oh yeah.
Because it starts off and like, well, you know, the U.S. owns it. It's like before that, it's like, you know, Mexico owned it. Before that, you know, or it's like before that, Texas owned it. Like before that, Mexico owned it. Before that, the Spanish owned it. Before that, it was this. Before that, it was this group. Before that, it was this group. Before that, and it's like, and it just keeps going back and back and back and back and back. And it was just like, that's fascinating. It's like, and basically it was just this whole thing of like, this small little plot of land that nobody ever really thinks of was basically conquered by numerous people over thousands of years. So just I thought that was interesting. So.
Like the Normandy of North America.
Lubbock, Texas. Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and move on to August 1st. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this is a great one.
Yes, it is. Give it to us.
1776, composer of the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, was born in Carroll County, Maryland.
There you go.
So he was actually born in 1776.
Yeah. No. That's,
what?
Wait a second.
Or was it just that, okay, now we got to find this out.
Oh, I wrote this down wrong.
You must have wrote it down.
I totally did. This is hangover typing right here.
Hangover typing.
Yeah.
You did tell me that. He was born in 1779, so you were just off by one number.
See,
so
there you go. There's that dyslexia
for
you.
Yeah. So 1779 is when Francis Scott Key was born. Died January 11th, 1843. Lived a good long life.
You know what?
There.
Forget it, Brian. The legend's better. 1776, Francis
Scott
Key.
He was born in 1776, just after our nation was founded, and he knew he'd grow up one day and be an important figure.
Mm-hmm. He knew that he would grow up and rip off countless British melodies and place American patriotism upon them.
That does crack me up every time I hear, like, God Save the Queen. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, but that's not, you know, that's one of our songs that we sing. And it was just like this big, just screw you to Britain.
Well,
back
well,
in the day, I'm like, we're going to write songs. We're going to use the exact same freaking songs.
It's a slightly different melody, but it's exactly the same as a British bawdy song.
Oh, yeah.
Like it's a bar song. I forget what the lyrics are. It's about like a maid who gets her skirt lifted up by like some drunken dude.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That's right. America for you.
You're going to have to do the next one.
Of course I am. Okay. 1934, Lead Belly is released from prison again. Because, of course, prison was nothing new to Huddle William Ledbetter. Having done a stint on a chain gang, escaping in 1913, escaped from prison his first time.
Nice.
Yes. Then served 7 years for murdering a relative.
A relative?
Yes. But his conviction in 1930 was slightly different. He was arrested for attempted murder of some random guy.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. So he was sentenced to something like 30 years. But in 1933, a father and son folklorist group named John and Alan Lomax came to visit him. And they heard that he was a great singer.
Mm.
So they came back again later in 1933 and recorded him. And came back again in 1934 and recorded him again. And eventually, they decided that they're going to try and petition for a gubernatorial pardon. So they took a 45 and recorded themselves putting out their case for releasing Ledbetter.
Nice.
Leadbelly, right? They sent it to Governor Oscar J. Allen of Louisiana. And that was the special request on Side A. And Side B, they put Goodnight Irene. And 2 months later, Ledbetter was out.
Wow. That's a great story.
And there was a small scandal about it.
How's
Governor
there not a
movie
made about this so far?
Yeah, I know, right? Well, probably because like Ledbetter was a real jackass for the first like 30 years of his life and then drank himself to death. So like
apparently
it's,
not so
it's,
much of a Ledbetter.
Right. There's a really good feel-good story in Act 2, but Act 3 is dark as hell.
Oh, see, that'd make a great movie, though.
Right, and also, who sings like him?
Oh, well, I mean, that's true. I mean, I'm sure they could find somebody.
Well,
might be
yeah.
able to sing
well you're right. I mean, there's 7 billion people in the world. You find somebody.
Somebody. All right, now, this one, it's a short one, obviously, but do you want to do this one, and then I'll do the next one?
Yeah, here we go. So,
go for it.
1960, we got a birthday.
Yes.
Chuck D.
Chuck D.
Of Public Enemy.
Public Enemy.
And Just Awesomeness is born in Queens, New York.
Yes. So Chuck D is one of those figures that like he just.
You said it right. Figure. Like he's bigger than a man at this point.
Yes, he is. He's one of the like founders of hip hop and rap, just going off and like making just some amazing music.
Yes.
And he's got that incredible voice, mm-hmm. just that, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe. Because it's angry
like,
and dark.
It's like a father just dropping wisdom on you.
Yeah, yeah. No, that is exactly right. But, I mean, of course, I mean, in Public Enemy, he was huge.
Oh, yeah.
And now that he's touring with the Prophets of Rage.
Who are so good.
Yeah, I mean, like, the last single that I heard that mm-hmm. they dropped, and I listened to it, and I played it for a friend of mine, and we were just like, oh, my goodness. Like, this is
Was that Unfuck the World?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, my God. It's
good,
so good
stuff.
It's
good,
so good
stuff. So there you go. Chuck D, happy birthday, man. I hope you have a good one. So, and he's getting up in there in age, isn't he? He's, let's see.
Well, 1960. So 57.
So he's 57. Yep. He's yeah. You did that math way faster than me. I looked on Wikipedia. I'm never good at math. I'm a drummer. I count to four and repeat.
There you go.
But here we go. 1960. On the same day Chuck D was born,
mm-hmm.
something else major impacted the world, and that was Chubby Checker releasing The Twist, which is the greatest dance craze to ever hit. The face of the world. No, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
It is true.
You don't think that the waltz?
No. The twist defined a generation.
Okay.
And I mean, it is still being done to this day, as referenced by Pulp Fiction,
mm-hmm.
with that great dance scene, which apparently Quentin Tarantino actually kind of like showed them what to do, and then they kind of like did their own version of it. So it wasn't like it was super choreographed, but
yeah.
Quentin Tarantino was just like, do this, look like this. but yeah, no, like the twist ended up becoming just a massive success, and it really kind of solidified like rock and roll in the hearts of a lot of people. Because before, you know, they may have listened to some mm-hmm. rock and roll and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
They may have liked certain things. But when the twist actually came out, like it was like hardcore. And it
yeah.
was like, oh, this stuff can really be danced to.
Oh yeah.
So
dude, Chubby Checker used to bring the house down. Like how many times we covered him in riots happening at shows?
Yeah. Like, I mean, just.
And if you listen to that original twist recording, he is singing his ass off.
Oh yeah.
On that recording.
Yes.
You know, and you don't get it because, you know, anytime he's on like the Ed Sullivan show, he's lip syncing to it. You know, you don't realize that he's just screaming from the other side of a room into a microphone.
Yeah.
Because that
come on, baby.
Yeah.
Let's do the twist. Yeah. He was just screaming that out. So, but man, I'm trying to, what was the name of the guy who did the, like the New Year's Rockin' Eve? And all of that stuff. And he was American Bandstand.
Dick Clark
actually said that the twist was like the most important like musical thing to happen in America. And, you know, because, I mean, it was just a massive thing for him,
yeah.
obviously. But it was because it became this huge dance craze. Everybody started doing it. It was a super simple thing to do.
Yeah. How many really terrible like dance craze songs came out after that?
Too many.
I mean, the Mashed Potatoes, not bad.
No, but I mean, we can just go through the entire song from Blues Brothers.
Night of a Thousand Dances.
Well, Ben, Shake Your Tail Feathers.
Yeah.
it's like, I can mash potato, I can do the twist.
Yeah.
That's another song, though. That's Do You Love Me Now That I Can Dance?
Yeah.
Do you love me? The other thing is that the twist then spawned like a ton of other twist songs.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Let's twist again like we did last summer. It's like, you know, the Beatles did the twist. I mean, like, it was basically the song to do, like, for a long time. Also, I wanted to tell you, I completely forgot about this, but I looked it up. Jazzist actually is a word.
Oh, okay, all right.
It has nothing to do with being a player of jazz.
Okay.
It is just a person who loves jazz.
Oh.
So there you go. Sorry.
Well, I guess I used that improperly then.
Oh, but it was still good. Still sounds good. It's not a word that's commonly used. So.
I'll tell you what's good is my next note.
Go for it.
Because this might be my pick of the week.
Oh, okay. Then I'm going to listen intently.
Okay. 1963. Leon Ivey Jr. is born in Compton.
Okay.
He later gets his stage name from one of the best rips of all time when a friend saw him playing with a guitar and said, "Who do you think you are, Coolio Iglesias?"
Coolio. So,
in a straight up Coolio move, he took a rip and turned it into his identity.
That is kind of funny that a lot of the rappers I've heard ended up getting their nicknames from other people.
Yeah.
Ice Cube got it from his brother because his brother said he was going to lock him in the fridge until he turns into an ice cube. And so he then just came out and he's like, you know, and he like just took that name like because of that. But yeah, that's Coolio Iglesias.
Coolio, who do you think
so
you
it's like
are?
Totally
Iglesias.
Just messing up like somebody else's name and then just be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna take that Coolio. Not too many people know though that Coolio is actually a pretty good cook.
Yes, he
and he
yeah.
has a cookbook called Cooking with Coolio.
Cooking with Coolio.
And he appeared on like one of the Guy versus Rachel celebrity cook-off mm-hmm. whatever thing and actually did really well on that show and like kind of blew them away
yeah.
like with how good he actually could cook. So
I think my favorite like anything with Coolio in it though is this YouTube show called Hot Ones where they eat a bunch of like hot wings
mm-hmm.
and when he gets to the 10th the last wing he took the entire bottle of hot sauce and just dumped it on the wing and ate it. Right. Now his face turned red and he started, you know, blowing snot rockets afterwards, but it was still the coolest, most baller move of anyone on that show. Just say, you know what, screw your hot sauce. Like, fuck your hot sauce. I'm gonna dump this all over this wing and eat it.
Wow.
It was pretty badass. Anyway.
Here you go. I got one for you, Jessica. I added this to you just because I know you dabble in the harmonica playing. But in 1964, Billboard magazine reported that the harmonica was making a comeback in a big way, thanks to its use by Stevie Wonder, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and Bob Dylan. Of course, after Dylan was doing it, then everybody had to buy like those headset things, you know, so you could put it in front of you and play it while playing guitar. So that, I mean, let's face it, Dylan really couldn't play the harmonica.
No,
he just had the same key that he was playing in, and he just kind of went up and down and... And that was it, but...
Stevie Wonder can play a harmonica.
Stevie Wonder can rock a harmonica, and he's usually got, like, the bigger one.
The chromatic one.
Yeah, then he can...
With the slider bar.
Yeah, with the slider bar, and he can do that. I know the Rolling Stones, they basically played blues harp. Same thing with the Beatles, especially with their song, Should've Known Better.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I should've known better. You know, that one. Because the start of the song starts off with the harmonica playing. That's a good one. That's on the Hard Day's Night soundtrack.
Okay.
Boom. So, but then after that, you know, huge harmonica thing. I know you still dabble. So there you go. I put that one in for you.
I appreciate that.
Let's jump forward to 1971. Another huge thing that happened.
Oh, let's hear about it.
The Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour debuts.
What?
So there you go. Sonny and Cher, of course, the classic husband-wife duo who gave us such great songs as Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves, and then I Got You, Babe, and that's all I can remember.
There's a lot of clips from the show on
YouTube. Yeah, they were actually really funny together. I mean, that's you know, something that a lot of people don't understand. Like, they think of Cher, and they think of Cher now. Where they think of Cher, like, in sort of the early 90s or late 80s.
The battleship with the fishnets and leather jacket.
Yes, and the giant hair and all of that.
Was that the Missouri that they filmed that on?
Ooh, I don't remember. But I remember it being, like, a huge deal because it was basically her in a thong and fishnets. And, like, yeah, I mean, it was kind of goofy. But, I mean, you can fault Cher for a lot of stuff. Like, I mean, especially in the music that she created, like, in the last, you know, couple decades. But fact of the matter is that her time with Sonny was really good. I mean, you could talk about Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves, but fact of the matter is it's a good song.
Yeah.
The same thing with I Got You, Babe. Yeah, it was overplayed like crazy. And especially if you've seen Groundhog Day, it's played in that movie like 400 times. But it's still
cold out here. It's cold out here every
It's Groundhog Day.
Don't forget your booties.
What is this? Miami Beach? Hardly.
Oh God. You know, it's not so bad the first time, but man, you really feel the dread hearing that like the 47th time, man.
So but yeah, I mean, and I even know about how Sonny wanted to write the song that actually had that waltz time signature.
Okay, yeah.
And that's in the entire reason why that song was written, because he loved that boo. Which is the rhythm of the song. You know, but yeah. So he wrote the entire song because he wanted to write kind of a waltz.
Okay.
Which makes sense because it's a waltz.
Yeah.
So. But there's good harmonies and stuff in there too. And it's got that, got like that oboe in there.
Yeah, yeah.
That plays in the background, and all around, just a very well-produced song. So, but let's see. Let's move on. You can do this one.
Okay, then.
Even though it has my name in it. Go for it.
This one? No, it doesn't. 1973.
Oh, sorry. I skipped a day. Fact, so, yeah.
Here we go. 1973, the concert for Bangladesh takes place. It's actually over 2 days. But the concert for Bangladesh was the very first, like, high-profile benefit concert that attracted A-list talent to it.
And it wasn't done in Bangladesh, was it?
No, it was not.
I was going to say, because I'm...
No, because it was done at Madison Square Garden in New York City. And it was calling attention to what was once called East Pakistan, then began becoming Bangladesh.
Yes.
And the war and genocide that happened there.
Mm.
Yeah, because, you know, ethnic cleansing is always...
Yeah.
That's always like a high tempo number. But, yeah, George Harrison and Ravi Shankar were the two producers of the show.
Yes.
And they really got a whole lot of people to come out to it. And it was considered a success at the time, even though now the funds that were gathered for it and actually donated, I think something like $200,000 actually went to relief funds, which, considering that the show made like $250,000, is actually a really good percentage to go to the cause.
Yes.
So they got that right. And also, it was a really good show, and people didn't stop talking about it for a number of years, and it's kind of set the stage for what every benefit concert that has followed it. Let's see. Ringo Starr was there. George Harrison, Ravi Shankar, Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, Billy Preston, Leon Russell, and Badfinger.
Wow.
So, yeah, A-list talent at the time for sure. And
definitely.
Even now, A-list talent. So,
for those of you who are also wondering, Bangladesh is on the eastern side of India.
Yes, next to Pakistan.
So, I was just looking at the little map here. So, yeah, no, I honestly, I had no idea the concert even existed. So,
really? I still hear people talk about it.
No, like, I mean, I know, like, Live Aid or, mm-hmm. you know, the stuff for Africa and,
yeah.
you know, that kind of stuff, but I don't know.
It's also important in that it sort of laid the
Farm Aid.
It really laid the networking for the Ringo Starr All-Stars.
Oh, yeah?
Like, because Eric Clapton and Ringo kind of, like, I think they were next to each other in hotel rooms.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, like, where they were... kind of buddy-buddy there. Anyway.
Nice.
So, yeah. It's noteworthy. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it.
All right. Well, then, if you took that one with about George Harrison, I'll take 1980. George Harrison forms a production company to help Monty Python's Flying Circus make The Life of Brian.
Oh.
Which is not my favorite Python movie.
Really?
Holy Grail is still my favorite.
Well, fair enough. This one has grown on me over time, though.
Yeah, it's still funny. Don't get me wrong, but it cracks me up because it was always
there you
the
go,
life
getting
of
yourself
Brian.
Crucified.
It's like the gamble pays off when handmade films actually makes money. Like, however, after two decades of making the only important movies to come out of England, the doors closed in 1991 and was sold to pay debts in 1993. Harrison later sued the studio's president for fraud and was awarded nearly £12 million in 1996. So, there you go.
Yeah, if you look up Handmade Studios, or Handmade Films
yes.
Studios. Yeah, it's a really rotten title. Handmade Films Studios.
You want to know what I actually kind of was surprised about recently? And I just discovered this, that you remember Orion Pictures?
Yeah.
So, they went bankrupt.
Yes.
And the only reason why I know they went bankrupt is because they did the movie we talked about in the previous week, I believe, was UHF.
Yes.
So Orion did UHF. And on the commentary for the UHF DVD, Weird Al goes, like, when the Orion thing starts up and it plays their little jingle, he goes, "We're bankrupt now," and, like, sings along with it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, well, that's kind of funny. So they, like, closed down Orion and all of that. But then, like, 3 years ago, like Universal or whatever resurrected it.
Yeah.
So Orion's back to making pictures again, and they're using the exact same intro they did back then.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. It's like, this makes me feel happy again
because
Orion, like, always produced, like, the worst movies that we loved.
That's true.
So
that
there
is
you
true.
Go.
But Handmade Films, if you do any reading on them, you'll find people making comments like they were making really good artistic movies at a time when Britain didn't have money to do anything.
Yeah.
So
these were the worst years of the Bond films.
So it's kind of sad that he got so screwed over with the fraud case, you know, with just being defrauded as an investor.
Yeah.
Because if Handmade Films was still around, I'm sure that they would, again, be doing artistically important films.
Yes, that is true.
As opposed to just being a subsidiary of another studio.
All right, you can do the next one.
Okay. Do you want to do these together, or do you want to say our bit and then come back to it?
Okay, let's do the two of them together since they're related.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about them.
That's fine. So,
let's do the first one.
Yes.
Go ahead.
1981 MTV goes live with Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yep. And then in 1987, on the same day, August 1st, MTV Europe goes on the air with the song Money for Nothing, which, of course, contains the lyric, I want my MTV. Yes. Dire Straits.
Yes, it is.
Yes, I love...
A mere 6 years later.
I've actually really grown to like Dire Straits just in the last, like, year or two. Because of... I found out about Mark Knopfler's, like, solo work, and he did the song Boom Like That, which has the line, my name is Croc, that's Croc with a K, like crocodile, but not spelled that way. And so it's become like my family song. My dad and I still talk about it and stuff. So it's like, but because he wrote that song, like, you know, I started listening to a lot more stuff and started listening to Sultans of Swing like started listening to the way that he plays guitar and stuff. Just love that stuff. But let's get back to MTV.
Every time somebody talks to me about the Eagles and how great their guitar melodies are, no.
Yeah.
Everything is overshadowed by Dire Straits. Their guitar melodies on Sultans of Swing is...
Yes, exactly.
Just stellar. Anyway.
But let's go back. 1981, of course, MTV goes on air with Video Killed the Radio Star, which was a song that was done a few years before that.
Yes.
But the music video that they played for the first time was because it was Video Killed the Radio Star. And they were like, we're going to change the world. We're going to do this. It's going to be awesome. So they played that music video instead of like going with something new. But MTV had like just in the times when they did play music, because of course they don't play music anymore.
Right.
That's like saved for other stations that they may own. I don't remember, but they do still play music. They do stuff that is music related still, but for the most part, their lineup is dominated by reality TV shows. But back in the day when they were doing music videos, completely revolutionized the music industry because the music video became the way to actually promote your stuff.
Yes.
And so people were forced to then do music videos just to put them on MTV so they could then actually get their music sold. And people could actually, like, with no real music background or no, like, discography to speak of, could become massive successes because they fully embraced the visual format.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to the older folks, not older folks, but the ones who were, you know, just slightly behind them, who are like, what are you talking about? The music should speak for itself. We don't need a visual format. This is music. You know, what's the big deal? You know, but then that leads to the rise of people like Madonna.
And Prince, even.
Prince and Michael Jackson. Yeah. And like all of these people who really embrace the visual form to create great music
and,
videos.
You know, it's funny that, like you say, Michael Jackson, because a lot of people would say, well, wait, he was with the Jackson 5.
He was, yes.
But it's really because of Thriller and that album that he outsold the rest of the Jacksons.
Mm-hmm.
Because he had released his own solo album that did not outsell the Jacksons.
It did not.
But when Thriller came around suddenly, and it's all because of MTV, really.
Yeah. I mean, if Michael Jackson hadn't gotten on MTV and done as well as he did, I mean, like, he wouldn't be as regarded as well as he is now at all. I mean, he wouldn't have become the Prince of Pop.
Right.
You know, but there you go. So then, of course, you know, a few years later, MTV Europe goes on the air. And I know nothing about them.
Well, it's interesting to me that 6 years later, they're not predicting the future by saying we're going to change the landscape of pop music.
Yeah.
Right. They're now saying that we are the icon by playing
I Want My MTV.
Yeah, Money for Nothing. Yeah.
And I remember all those clips that they used to play of like other famous people who were just like, you know, I was like, I want my MTV. I want my MTV. Yeah, yeah. Billy Idol, freaking, I want my MTV.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the great catchphrase, and you get all these celebrities to say it. It's like, I mean, it's, you know, it just works out really well. Like, that marketing writes itself. But I honestly don't know anything about MTV Europe. I don't know what they did or anything like that, but...
I mean, okay, well, so television in Europe is a lot different than it is in the States.
Yeah.
Because they had the European Union show up in the 70s, and everyone was... working with each other instead of against each other in their broadcast bandwidths. So it's not like there's anything to really know about it other than it was MTV, except that they were broadcasting to more than one nation at a time, and they kind of had like a rather than everyone listening in Sweden, only listening to Swedish artists, they were now listening to people from Germany and people from Spain and people from the UK.
Yeah. So I think it's funny, though, that, you know, MTV Europe goes up there, but that's after, like, the British invasion, the second British invasion has already happened. You know, so, like, there were a bunch of other bands that, of course, already had, like, videos that they could play on there. So it must have been a lot easier to set that one up, you know, that time around. So I like that, though. It's a nice little bit in music history that really changed the direction of the music industry.
Yeah.
You know, just like the internet completely changed the direction of the music industry. You know, vinyl records changed the direction of the music industry. Long play vinyl records changed the direction of the music industry.
It's
you know, the rise of albums.
I mean,
so.
But MTV, you can really chart everything for about 20 years.
Yeah.
Because there's a rise of the visual artist, right? And then there's the pinnacle of that, which was Milli Vanilli. And then the rebellion of that, which was Seattle Sound and the grunge era. Right? And then the bounce back for the death of the grunge era. And that's all based on 1981, channel going live on cable doing nothing but music videos.
When I was in college, the one of my teachers who's a bit older than me, not a bit, like, I mean, he was still in our generation, but he was, you know, like 5 years older, and he was talking about how he remembers the day that he came, like, downstairs to eat breakfast. He put on MTV. And he's like, I had my long hair. He's like, and I was all into the hair metal and stuff like that. It's like, growing up, he's like, I was all into the guitar playing and stuff like that. He goes, and I turned on MTV, and they played Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. He goes, and it just destroyed my world. he's like, from the second I saw that, I knew hair metal was dead. And it was like, that's basically what happened. Hair metal was all huge, and then it was like, boom, you're now dead because something else has just killed you and taken your place. So... But yeah, I mean, the visual medium introduced a lot of different artists to a new audience and created all sorts of fun stuff. This is definitely going on the notes for the post, too, because, I mean, MTV, we can give them flack all day long for what they became, but what they were was brilliant in its day. So, I mean, not to mention, you gave the rise of, like, Mike Judge.
yeah.
Like, with Beavis and Butthead, and then, like, of course, him going off and doing all sorts of fun stuff, of which actually my wife, like, last night watched Office Space for the first time, and
really?
She cracked up.
How do you get through life doing this?
Well, I mean, this is also a woman who didn't see Star Wars until, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I finally made her do it. It was her birthday present to me. I said, I want you to... I want you to watch Star Wars. And she's like, okay, fine. So then we watched Star Wars, and then it was just in time for the new movie to come out.
This is what marriage is,
The Force
folks.
Awakens.
Requesting a companion to watch a film.
Hey, I finally got her to watch Firefly 2, and she loved it.
Of course she does.
Loved it.
Of course she does. Because it's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I finally got her to watch Office Space, like, last night. And this all day today, she's been telling me about, or she's been posting gifts of stuff from the movie. But she loved Milton. That was her favorite. All right, let's move on. August 2nd, what do we got? Born on this day, 1937. August 2nd, Garth Hudson, who is, of course, the organ / piano / horn player / thousand other instruments that he actually plays.
Okay.
Garth Hudson of the band. And I mean, the man is just a brilliant musician, and I love watching clips of him playing just by himself, because he'll just sit there and he'll just play, and then, like, all of a sudden he'll just laugh at something that he did. Like, that's great. I love somebody who takes that much joy in what they're doing. So just, there you go. That's all I got, though. Happy birthday, Garth.
Happy birthday, Garth.
But you got one here.
Yeah, I teased you with this.
You teased me with
earlier.
This one early.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead.
Okay,
tell the story.
There is a wealth here of an artist who has been completely forgotten.
Completely forgotten.
Yeah, well, yeah, near enough to completely forgotten. As close as we're going to get to that. So 1951, Andrew Gold is born in Burbank, California. Now, he is the son of Academy Award winner, composer Ernest Gold.
Okay. Right?
His most famous composition is the theme from the movie Exodus.
Yeah.
Which you would recognize if you heard it.
Yeah, I'm sure I would.
Yes. Now, he's also a U.S. to the U.K. transplant, went to school over there, and he scored a record contract at Polydor Records at age 16 in the United Kingdom. Right. He followed that with his first single, was a record in 1967 titled Of All the Little Girls. And it was with a friend of his titled Villers and Gold was the group.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 70s, he started writing songs and eventually hooked up with Linda Ronstadt and started selling songs to her and writing songs just for Linda. And in 1974, he helped her cut her most successful and iconic album, Heart Like a Wheel. Never toured with her, didn't play in her band, but he did cut almost all the tracks on You're No Good, which is what you think of when you think of Linda Ronstadt, right?
Yeah, that's You're No Good, You're No Good, You're No Good, Baby, You're No Good.
Yes. Now, he didn't write that, but he did write the accompaniment for it.
Oh, okay.
Right. And played most all the songs. All his tracks ended up on the album. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Right. Now, eventually, he started doing his own. I'm sorry. You're No Good is actually, it's a Dee Dee Warwick song.
Oh, okay.
That was written in the 40s. However, his remix of it is the one everyone thinks of.
Yeah.
And that's Dionne Warwick's sister, by the way.
Yes.
Dee Dee Warwick, if you were wondering. So to talk about his solo work, really includes a lot of really timeless songs that you might not have heard in the U.S., but were gigantic in England and the U.K.
Oh, okay.
Right. So everyone knows Thank You for Being a Friend, which was the theme song from...
Thank You for Being a Friend.
Yes. Beautiful melody.
Down the road and back again.
However, Let Her Slip Away also kind of came across the pond and was a hit here. But Lonely Boy is the big song everyone thinks of when they think of Andrew.
Because
it was a massive sledgehammer in the UK. Everyone knows that song. There's stories that people talk about people giving standing ovations, anticipating the chorus coming up. Like in the middle of a song, people just jumping out of their chairs.
Yeah.
Because it's a really like high-tempo rock song with a piano accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the definition of an upbeat number. However, Andrew died of heart failure at age 1959, at age 59, which I think was too young for him.
Yeah, that's pretty young.
Yeah. And I think it's a shame that more people don't know Andrew Gold's work, or don't at least know him by name.
Well, then that's what we're going to have to remedy. I'm going to mark that note just so I can put it on the show description just for you, Jack.
Oh, well, thank you, Brian.
So there you go. How about that?
How about that? But here's something we can just chat about.
Yes.
1956, an article in Look magazine states that Elvis receives 3,000 fan letters per week.
Wow.
Not per week. Per week.
You said not per week.
Yeah, not per year, not per
month, but per week.
Per week. So he was employing several postmen at that point, I think.
I'm sure that it was just being delivered to like the label or something.
Either way, there was a postman on the streets because.
That is true. Well, they might have just delivered like in a full truck who was just like, here you go, yeah, here's a giant bag.
We just throw them in the truck back there. We don't even put them in bags. We just throw them in the truck.
Oh, man. Let's see, though. Oh, 1962. Here we go. Aretha Franklin makes her first appearance on television on American Bandstand singing Don't Cry Baby and A Little Tenderness.
I like A Little Tenderness.
I do. I like her version.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. I mean, I like everything Aretha Franklin does.
Undeniable.
I'm still amazed that whenever they did that, like, Divas on Stage thing, mm-hmm. and Aretha was there, and she just, like, floored all of the other ladies that were up there. It's like all these other women who are powerhouse singers are known for it, and she just killed them all. The only woman that I've ever seen even come remotely close to being the powerhouse singer of Aretha Franklin, there's a couple of other the Motown ladies, but Patti LaBelle is about the only one who comes even remotely close, in my opinion. And that's just because Patti knows how to sing. Not sing. She knows how to sing.
You know what? I think Patti LaBelle might not be the strongest vocalist, vocalist in R&B, but she sings a song better than most people.
That is true.
Like, she just dynamics, she really understands it and knows how to turn out a song and keep the crescendo always going.
Well, I mean, if you ever want to see something kind of amazing, there's video of at some performance, I don't remember, it's a live performance, but it's Patti LaBelle and Michael Bolton singing a duet together.
Oh, okay.
And it's just amazing. Like, it's honestly just one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Because you think of Michael Bolton, you know, it's like, yeah, he's a good, strong singer. Mm-hmm. But he's honestly one of the only dudes that I've ever seen who can match Patti LaBelle.
Really?
It's like, and I mean, he's hitting high notes and like just powering through these great harmonies and stuff with her. I mean, amazing stuff. So, yeah.
That's, you know, a lot of people just trash on what pop music is today with all the features and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get two vocalists that can match each other, like really tit for tat for power or for range or whatever their niche is, it really is something else. It's a whole nother bag. It's a whole nother ball of wax.
Yep. Speaking of a whole nother ball of wax.
Let's go
for it.
1962.
Yes, the same day that Aretha Franklin makes her first appearance on television.
Robert Zimmerman legally changes his name to Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and the world was forever changed.
You love saying that. Billy Jack and the world was forever changed.
Billy Jack, the movie that changed a generation. We're not sure which one, but it changed
it. Before we go off on Bob Dylan,
let's
wrap this next one into it.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so 1969.
Yes.
Bob Dylan, no longer Robert Zimmerman, returns home for his 10-year high school reunion, and folks at Hibbing, Minnesota agree he's still weird.
Mm-hmm.
The event was held in a moose lodge, and most of his classmates were very upset over remarks he had made about Hibbing to journalists. Several journalists, actually. In a Telegraph article, one classmate refused to give his name publicly, but said, "Bob doesn't care about Hibbing, so why should we care about him? Besides, I don't like his music."
That's funny. I like that. I was just thinking about this too, Jake, because I was thinking about, you know, high school reunions and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And in a few years, you know, we're going to have our 20th of having been graduated.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was thinking, we've got a quarter of the class in this room right now.
I know, right?
Like, it shouldn't be that hard to get other people involved. So,
but do we want to? That's the question.
You know what? I might actually want to at 20.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Just get together, maybe have dinner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing. I mean, I'm like, we couldn't do something big, but I mean, a bunch of us are now like living in the area again.
Right.
So it's like, it wouldn't be that hard.
Can't
to pull
be
off.
That hard to track down eight people. Well, six
no.
people.
Well, that's
because I mean, we've already tracked down two, but yeah.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be that hard
this
to do. I know where pretty much everybody
is. This is terrible audio to listen to right now.
I'm just saying. It's just, you know,
fair enough.
People know they talk about, my parents were talking about, because they're doing like this next year. My mom is doing her 50th high school reunion. I was like, oh my God, like that's so long to think about. And then I was like, oh crap, we're like just a couple years from 20.
Yeah, I know, right?
So yeah, now there, I can understand that though, somebody going back to the high school reunion and be like, hey, that Robert Zimmerman, he's still just a weird dude.
Actually, in reading this, the sentiments were really kind of all over the place.
I'm
like,
sure.
Some people were like, look, nobody really understood what Bob was doing then, now, and they probably won't later on.
He was probably just some loner type kid, actually, in school.
Yeah.
I mean, like, he obviously wasn't a popular person, so, like, he poured himself into music and then just happened to create something good with it, so, you know.
Yeah, there was another guy who was a really good friend of his in high school who was upset that he was too outgoing now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he wanted his wallflower to come back and hang in the corner with him.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Which I guess is kind of sweet. But this story, this is one
you're going to have to do, yeah.
I've got to do this one. Okay. So 1983, James Jamerson dies from many health issues caused by his drinking at age 47.
Yes.
The session bassist was a Motown staple and played on 30 or more Billboard number ones.
Mm-hmm.
Billboard number, not R&B number ones, not Motown number ones. Billboard number ones.
Billboard number ones.
As a member of the Funk Brothers,
yes,
he is one of the most, well, probably the most influential bass player of the modern recording age, and has collaborated with every single R&B artist that matters.
Mm-hmm.
Just to name a few, there's Stevie Wonder, The Supremes, The Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Four Tops, Marv Johnson, and John Lee Hooker.
Yes.
Because, hey, who doesn't like some John Lee Hooker? More impressive still, though, and you'll probably agree with this, Brian, than just his single body of work, is that every single iconic, or every single song from an artist that's their iconic song,
mm-hmm,
he played on, right? Like, for example, the bass line from My Girl,
mm-hmm,
which somehow takes a bass line and puts it totally up front of the song, but without being garish.
Mm-hmm.
Also, here's another food for thought. The Funk Brothers have more hits than the Beatles.
I knew that one.
Yeah.
Yet they were completely unknown until that documentary was made about them.
Right. Who's your favorite R&B artist? Smokey Robinson. Do you know who played the music on Smokey Robinson's album? Was it his band? No, it wasn't. It was the Funk Brothers.
Yeah.
Or some of them. It's or at the, least one of them.
To
but
me,
we know it was them.
To me, like, there are two influential bands. I take that back. There's really about four influential bands in music,
yeah,
that were like studio bands. You've got the Funk Brothers in Motown.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Wrecking Crew in,
yes,
L.A. You've got the guys down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the dudes from Stax Records.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those four right there are probably responsible for more number one hits, more songs that people remember than anybody else like that has ever existed.
You're right. Those four groups of session artists are probably responsible for 50% of everything that was played on the radio,
mm-hmm,
from like 48 to like MTV.
Yeah.
Till 81.
Easily. I mean, like, those groups, they influenced practically everybody else too. I mean, if it wasn't for them, like, a ton of the other, like, British artists,
mm-hmm,
wouldn't have any,
yeah,
of the music that they have. I mean, the Wrecking Crew alone, like, did basically everything that came out,
mm-hmm,
of California, including, you know, my favorite album, Pet Sounds by the Beach,
yeah,
Boys. And just...
You know, I just realized we've probably never just defined what session artists are.
Well, I mean, they're just, they're paid for their work, you know,
right.
It's like they're not given writing credit or anything,
right,
of the sort. So they're paid to come in, record a part, and then that's it.
Right. Sometimes, like, a lot of people think that a session artist is somebody who comes in, looks at a piece of sheet music, plays their piece, and then goes home. Right.
Yeah.
Funk Brothers were not that at all.
No.
Smokey Robinson would come in with some lyrics and maybe a piano that he was playing that had a little melody on it, and he,
mm-hmm,
would play it. And then the Funk Brothers would write the song for him.
Yeah.
They would hammer it out, and then he'd come in after they were done and lay his vocals.
Yep.
And then his band would learn what they played.
Yep. Whenever they went out.
Right. And the other three groups you mentioned, Muscle Shoals, the Wrecking,
yep,
Crew, and...
Stax Records.
Stax Records.
Which, of course, Steve
the
Colonel Cropper, Donald,
yeah,
Duck Dunn.
Donald Duck Dunn.
And, oh, man, why am I blanking on the other guy? The other one who did Green Onion with him. Do-do-do-do-do. I'm looking it up. Green Onions and Booker T.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, just, like, those guys right there, like, the small group from Stax Records, just made so many great albums. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So that's why they then got them for the Blues Brothers later on.
Right.
It was like, okay, we've got to get Steve the Colonel Cropper
we
and Donald
Duck. We have to put
Duck
together
Dunn.
the best blues review ever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's like, so what do? You get the best musicians you can possibly find, you know, in music history. So, yeah, I mean, that's just, yeah, that one's a good one.
So, James Jamerson, thank you for the tunes. Thank you for the hits.
Yes.
And 47 was way too young.
Way, way, way too young.
But hey, it's time for News in the Weird.
Yes, is it?
It is time for News in the Weird. The year, 1992. The location, Austin, Texas. Psycho Billy performer Mojo Nixon is on stage playing the song Don Healy Must Die when Don Healy himself climbs out of the audience on the stage, grabs a microphone off of the drum kit, and begins to beatbox along with Mojo Nixon.
Wow.
The act was not planned. Later, Mojo Nixon said that it was the only time in his life he was ever left speechless. And most folks usually think of Don Healy, the founder of the Eagles, as a really earnest asshole of a person.
Mm-hmm.
However, it turns out maybe he had a sense of humor, too.
There you go. Speaking of a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah?
Next up on our list, in 2014, Weird Al Yankovic scores his first number one album with Mandatory Fun.
Well, wait, it wasn't Running With Scissors?
Was not Running With
Scissors.
It
wasn't Bad Hair Day.
Wasn't Dare To Be Stupid either.
Wasn't Dare To Be Stupid. Really?
Nope. His first number one album was Mandatory Fun.
In 2014.
In 2014. And it's like, honestly, that album like shot him to to really big stardom. He was always famous beforehand.
Yeah.
It's like, but when he came out with that one, that was like, you know, all of these great parodies of like newer songs, and everybody was well, I know the Lord song. It's like, but this is funny because he's doing Aluminum Foil. It's like, and then Word Crimes and like all that kind of stuff. But the other thing is that his marketing behind it was genius. It was, it's like every day I'm going to release another music video for another song.
Yeah.
Brilliant. I loved it. Like, that was so good. That was such a great thing to do.
Yeah. Really a way to cement yourself into like the binge culture, I guess, which is, I think,
and
a stupid
just
term.
Latching on to like the YouTube community, like with his videos and stuff. Loved it. Brilliant, brilliant
you
stuff.
Know, well, every like 10 years or so, that guy gets to just completely reinvent himself because there's new artists and new middle schoolers to cut their teeth on his work. So,
all right, let's get on through August 3rd. Of course, 1963, the Beach Boys released Surfer Girl, the first song Brian Wilson ever wrote and the first one he produced.
Ah, look at that.
It's a good little song written in 6/8, so I like that one a lot.
Can you imagine being the guy who, when Brian Wilson said, "Hey, you guys mind if I run the show on this one?" who thought, "I don't know if he's got what it takes."
Well, I think pretty sure his dad didn't think he had what it took to do it, but
yeah.
There you go. But let's go ahead and move on. And we got another birthday here. 1963. On the same day, the Beach Boys released Surfer Girl. So we got a couple of on the same days. In 1963, born on this day, James Hetfield, guitar and vocals for Metallica.
There you go.
I'm not a huge Metallica fan, but I do give them props just for they can write some catchy tunes. Yeah. So, but I'm not like a hardcore, you know, Metallica released a new album.
You're not a guy who's anything after Enter Sandman sucks.
No, I'm not that at all. I'll listen to anything and then judge it on its merit, but I don't really.
I talked to a guy who said that Metallica jumped the shark at And Justice for All. I'm like, what? So they had two albums that were good? You're crazy. Anyway.
All I know is that they put on a killer show at Busch Stadium. So
that's what you keep saying. I haven't seen anything from it. So
I didn't either. But yeah. I heard from people that it was amazing.
Yeah, I talked to a customer who went to it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she said she had like front row tickets and stuff.
One of our other podcast friends, the Next Gen Nerds, two of them went to see it. So, and they said it was amazing.
Didn't they do the VIP thing, right?
One of them did the VIP thing. So, or his wife did the VIP thing.
Okay.
So, got pictures of it. Ended up in their video too. The St. Louis bit afterwards. But let's see. It's a short one here, I guess. 1974.
Bad Company by Bad Company from Bad Company.
Hits number one.
There you go. Did you catch that?
Yes.
The band
Bad Company.
Wait, the song.
The song Bad Company.
The album.
The album Bad Company from
by
the
band
Bad Company.
Okay.
What's the lead singer's name on Bad Company? I'm blanking on his name. He was in the band Free beforehand, and he did the song All Right Now.
Right.
But then
so James Bad Company Buster.
Hey, if only I had a vast amount of information right at my fingertips. How about I just search in Bad Company and not get the video game?
You know what? Yeah, you could try that.
Paul Rogers.
Okay.
Bad Company.
You're on a different line than
I am. Sorry, it's what I did. I'm sorry. It's my fault. But yeah, no, Bad Company, of course, Roger Waters, a great singer. I mean, I was always a fan of Free.
Yeah.
Because the song All Right Now is just a brilliant song. But
baby, yeah. It's a whole right now, yeah.
So yes, but moving on, 1971, Paul McCartney announces the formation of his new group, Wings, with his wife, Linda, and former Moody Blues guitarist and singer, Denny Lane. Denny Lane is in my... Never mind, I'm not even going
to... No, no, not so much.
But yeah, that's it. Paul McCartney forms Wings.
You Wings fan?
I am, yeah. But I'm not like a huge, huge Wings fan. Band on the Run is a good album, though.
Yeah.
So, there you go. Let's see. Oh, yeah, and of course, another one that I put in here. 1985, Tears for Fears started a 3-week run at number one on the U.S. singles chart with Shout! Shout! Let it all out! These are the things I can do without. Come on!
Now.
Oh, so there you go. And recently I saw Tears for Fears. Yeah. They put on a great show, so I was very happy.
That the band name is almost a punchline to me.
It is almost a punchline. It's so emo, like yeah. Before emo was a thing.
I know, right? Oh, man. I mean, when you hit the nail on the head.
So, but to make it even more emo, though, it would have to be like, there'd have to be another metaphor thrown in there.
Uh-huh.
You know, like frozen tears for dead fears. You know, or something like that.
Yeah.
Or it's like, it's like stolen tears.
Oh my God. Just wrap yourself up in a poncho and watch The Crow already. God.
Oh, The Crow.
Really? I went back and watched that like
Man, I gotta admit, though, I was totally listening to some My Chemical Romance this last week.
Yeah, I know you were.
I couldn't help it.
I posted about it
because I was like, I can't help it. I was going through a bunch of MCR that day.
So. You know a place that My Chemical Romance has never played?
Where?
Rock Candy in Seattle.
There you go.
Which brings us to our next 1991 Pearl Jam films a show inside of Rock Candy, a Seattle nightclub. The multi-camera footage and audio are used to make a video for their first single, Alive. Rock Candy is another, like, dead venue. It's now a hotel or something. Like, who really cares? Because it's no longer a venue.
Mm-hmm.
But it was crazy important to the Seattle scene and the early Seattle sound era. Yeah, and just leading up to the Slacker Revolution, Rock Candy, there you go. But, hey, did you know, like, I always thought, all right, it just hit me that... The audio from the Pearl Jam video for Alive and the album aren't the same.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, it was always better to watch the video, and I just realized, it's like, oh, because that's a live recording, as opposed, like, every time I would call the point and request them to play Alive, and the DJ would groan because he had to play Alive again. And then I would be, like, a little disappointed with it because it's like, yeah, it doesn't sound the same. I just realized, oh, it's because it's not the same audio.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I mean, yeah. That's how they do that. Let's see. What do we got next? I'm so, okay, you can go ahead and do that.
No, one. I want you to read it.
Okay, fine.
I want you to read it without laughing.
1996, Grunge Dies, A Painful Death, as the Bayside Boys remix Macarena.
So there you go.
There was my deadpan news voice.
I appreciate
for you.
That. It was good.
My documentary voice.
That was everything I imagined it to be when I typed that out.
The Macarena.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is that only recently did people actually like understand what the lyrics were.
Okay, yeah.
And it's actually a really messed up song.
Is it?
Yeah. It's really kind of bad. It's like it's all about like cheating on somebody and like
oh.
All okay. This kind of stuff. It's not like a nice song. Oh, man. All right. So we got one more day for you.
Yes, we
August
do.
4th, we are going back, wrapping it all back around in a nice tight bow, going back to the great state of Louisiana with 1901, the great, the legendary Louis Armstrong is born in New Orleans, or Nolens, as
there you go.
As they like to say. But I kind of feel that since I'm not from there, I can't really say that.
I don't care. I like saying it that way.
I'm just saying. I got family down there, as we spoke about before. I still, like, I can't talk in their accent, like, unless I'm down there and I hear it. Mm-hmm. So I've tried. It just doesn't. But when I go down there, it's if I go down there and I hang out with them for like a week or so, I come back up and I'm talking like them. And I'm just like, oh, my God, like, I didn't mean to pick up your accent,
hey,
but I did.
Are your cousins still Paris Hilton fans?
I haven't talked
to any of them. I haven't seen them in so long.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I still keep in touch with my cousins down there. But
yeah.
It's sort of, you know, few and far between as far as like actually like having a real conversation with them. It's normally like they post something on Facebook and then we comment back.
Yeah, but
back and forth,
are they dropping that's hot all over Facebook anymore?
No, okay. No, of course not. Nobody is.
I just want to make sure.
There's somebody still in the corner of Facebook who's just like, that's hot. Like, those people need to be stopped.
Louis Armstrong, I can't say anything that hasn't already been said about the guy.
Just amazing.
Yeah.
He wasn't the greatest singer, but man, could he sing a song.
Oh, yeah.
So, and just brilliant horn player, everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Louis Armstrong. If you people listen to this haven't listened to Louis Armstrong, you're missing out just on amazing music. So, but let's move on to 1921. Let's see. I'll take this one. Why not?
Go ahead.
Herb Ellis is born in Farmersville, Texas. As a jazz guitarist, he played most often with, of course, the great Buddy Rich, and was instrumental in the Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald comeback album, Ella and Louis.
Yeah, that's a really good album, too. So you heard any of the songs off of it?
I've heard a few songs off of that. I have not listened to the entire collection, but yeah, no, it's just some great music. But
oh, yeah. you can't hate Buddy on anyone that's got Buddy Rich playing with him.
That is true. That is very true. Let's see here. 1941.
Yes, the film Holiday Inn premieres in New York City. Mm-hmm. It stars Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire with music by Irving Berlin. The only excuse you have for skipping it is that you hate America.
Of course, Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire, like, you know, doing their thing together. A classic film, Americana, like, just great stuff. So
yes, that is the song, or that's the movie that has White Christmas in it
originally.
Because it's been put in other Bing Crosby movies.
White Christmas
but it was written for Holiday Inn.
Yes,
which is a really weird movie. There's a love triangle, and there's a guy who is a Broadway star but then retires from it to live on a farm, and then his girlfriend decides she doesn't want to marry him anymore and wants to keep being a star, so she buddies up with Fred Astaire, and then he hates being a farmer, so he decides he's going to open an inn that is only open on holidays. It's all over the place. It's not really a great movie, I got to be honest with you. But Irving Berlin wrote all the music, and it's got two of the best, like, song and dance guys, or the two best song and dance guys ever.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, you can't go wrong with it. I mean, it's definitely a movie that people should watch if they love musicals and stuff too. So
yes.
I've always been a fan of musicals ever since I was a kid. So, you know, I'm happy about that one.
Who's your vote for the third best song in Dance Man?
Gene Kelly.
Not bad.
Easy for me. Gene Kelly's my favorite. So
is he really?
Oh yeah, because Fred Astaire was all like light on his feet.
Mm-hmm.
He was that kind of a dancer. He was real sort of soft and like all grand in his movements. Gene Kelly was more like the working man hero. You know, he was low to the ground. He would hit hard. You know, like all of his dance maneuvers or his dance moves were like really well thought out and really inventive in the space that they utilized.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that in Summer Stock he did that dance with the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how do you do that? It's like you're singing in the rain when he's dancing around with the
umbrella.
The umbrella, yeah. Of which he did that with the flu. Like,
yeah.
And that's just amazing. When he was dancing on the roller skates, like just, I forgot what movie that actually was. When he's going around on the roller skates, it's like the man just was so good at utilizing the stuff around him to dance that, I mean, to me, mm-hmm. Gene Kelly is like the epitome of a song and dance man that I appreciate. So he's top rank for me. Like Fred Astaire and like the rest of them, they're under Gene Kelly for me.
Okay.
But That's not going to say I'm not going to give props to Fred Astaire for right. being awesome at what he did. It's just that Gene Kelly was a different style, and that was the style that I liked.
I'm going to throw a wrench in this.
Okay, go ahead.
Right. Gregory Hines.
Okay, I mean, Gregory Hines is, of course, up there. I've seen the movie Tap like 20 times.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know.
The movie he did with Baryshnikov?
White Nights.
Yeah.
Also one of my favorite ones. And actually, that one led me to really loving, to finding and then really loving Vladimir Vysotsky.
Yeah.
The Russian folk singer
yeah.
who just amazing voice that's just pure gravel. Like, it's like, it's like, imagine, it's like, I know because you know who it is, but if you're listening to this and you haven't actually like found out about Vladimir Vysotsky, we did a review of Tom Waits a couple months ago. Like, that's kind of what he sounds like, but imagine him doing Russian.
Yeah. Tom Waits is kind of like trying to start a Studebaker that hasn't run in like 40 years. And Vladimir Vysotsky is...
He's got this super low voice, too.
He's a little bit more like stomping out a cigar with an oil drum on a gravel parking lot.
He's like, Zimmy Believer.
But Gregory Hines, I think it's kind of unfortunate that he was born in an era when that sort of like pop movie, the song and dance movie, wasn't as big as it was in previous eras.
No, but he was brilliant in White Nights. He was he was really, really good in Tap, you know, which had Sammy Davis Jr. in it. And it was like it was last movie or something. It was what that Sammy was in. And just like really, really great music there, too.
Yes. But History of the World Part 1.
History of the World Part 1, where, of course, he was just a comedic genius, you know, but it's kind of easy to be a comedic genius when Mel Brooks is writing all your lines. But yeah, no, for me, Gregory Hines isn't really a song man. He could sing, yes, but he was always more of a dance guy and like, you know, and like that kind of stuff. But for me, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, like those two guys were from a completely different era of like just all around awesome dudes. So there you go. I'm glad we brought that. That was a good one.
All right, 1958.
Splish Splash.
Splish Splash by Bobby Darin tops out at number 3 on Billboard's first release
now,
of the Hot 100.
Is that's the rock one, right? Splish Splash,
that
I
was
taking
a bath.
Boom,
boom, boom.
Up on a Saturday night.
Yes.
I could keep going. I'm not going to, though.
I could, too. It's a great song. Number 1, however, of course, was Ricky Nelson's Poor Little Fool. Number 2, couldn't find it.
Really?
Yeah. I couldn't find a list where it was actually out. Like, it's really easy to find the number ones, like what was number one week to week.
There should be a history of it somewhere, though.
I could not find it for 58. I tried. I'm sure it's out there somewhere. Like, there's some, like, dude who's typed out every Billboard, like, that's ever been posted. Typed it out himself on a typewriter and, like, keeps it in a journal somewhere in Wisconsin.
I'm looking it up on All Music
now. Well, you keep looking it up.
Go ahead. Go to the next one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here we go. Thank you for bringing this one in. 1967, a female Monkees fan stowed away on the band's plane between shows in Minneapolis and St. Louis. The girl's father threatened to bring charges of transporting a minor across state lines because he was really upset and had to take it out on someone. And it's really hard to do that to daddy's little girl.
That is true. That is very, very true. All right. I got the list. The first top 100.
Well, all right.
Right here.
Poor
Little Fool, Ricky Nelson. Patricia by Perez Prado and his orchestra is number 2.
I do not know that song.
Never heard it in my life.
I've never heard of the group either. Perez?
Yes.
Prado.
Perez
Prado.
Perez Prado. And his orchestra. The song was called Patricia.
Okay.
And then you shut your mic off there for a second, Jake.
Well, I was laughing too hard.
Splish Splash by Bobby Darin. Hard Headed Woman by Elvis Presley.
Round out the 5. Come on, what's 5?
And then When by the Kalin Twins.
Don't know that one either.
Which was written by Charles Evans and Jack
Kalin Redden. Twins. Are they like a sister group?
I don't
like
know, but
the...
But here, I'm gonna go down just a couple more just because I like this list. Rebel Rouser by Dwayne Eddy. Yakety Yak by The Coasters.
Oh, buddy.
My True Love by Jack Scott. Willie and the Hand Jive by Johnny Otis.
I've never heard of it.
You've never, like... just
Willie
like,
and the Hand Jive.
It's like they do the hand jive.
Oh, that's what that's
hand
from.
Hand jive.
That's what that is from.
Yes.
Is there lyrics to it, or is it just music?
No, it's pretty much just the hand jive. I think that's like the only real lyric of it. And then the last one, Fever by Peggy Lee.
Okay.
So there you go. That was a good
that's not
top 10.
That's a pretty good for Billboard's first list.
The first Hot 100. But apparently, I mean, if you go down, I mean, you've got people like Pat Boone, Jerry Butler and the Impressions, Doris Day, Bobby Freeman, Johnny Mathis.
Yeah,
Chuck Willis. Jeez, Dean Martin, Four Lads, Big Bopper.
So I guess the bigger story here is that Billboard kind of consolidated all their list into the Hot 100 for the first time.
Yeah, that's really what it was. So I mean,
because before they had separate lists for radio, for jukebox, and for several other things, right?
Yeah. Yep. It's just what it is. 1958. There you go. What do we got next, Jake?
A festival I've never heard of.
Really?
Yes, but I've heard you reference it.
Oh, you really? You've never heard of the Newport Pop Festival?
No.
It's the first time Dylan went electric.
That was at a festival?
Yeah,
at the Newport. I know, we talked about it last week, but...
Newport Folk and Pop Festival.
Oh, okay, well...
And it's kind of changed names over the years, because it was originally the Newport Jazz Festival, and then it became like the Newport...
Jazz
and Folk,
yes,
and it was like the Newport Folk, and then it was Folk and Pop, and then it was Pop, and it's like...
Yeah.
So it's kind of changed, but yeah, Dylan goes out there and plays electric to a folk crowd for the first time, and like, they went ballistic. They were just like, what is this noise? Like, I saw like, interviews of teenagers when they walked out of there, and they were just like, I don't know what happened. What was that I was listening to? I was like, Dylan Electric. Like, you guys have never heard rock and roll in your life? It's like, you thought that folk was like the end-all be-all of music?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
That's children for you, Brian.
I know how it is, because, you know, it's like you find a band or an artist that you really, really like in a certain style, and then all of a sudden they do something completely different, and you're like, no!
Right. It's the same. It's the 14-year-old equivalent to the 4-year-old, I want a popsicle. I'm sorry, we don't have any popsicles. I want a popsicle. I'm sorry, we don't have any popsicles, but I want a popsicle.
Yeah.
It's the 14-year-old equivalent to that.
I mean, recently in the last few years, of course, I mean, another band that did something kind of similar, you've got Mumford & Sons.
Yeah.
Mumford & Sons, known for this folk kind of Americana like sound that they have, you know, with their upright bass and all of that kind of stuff and their vocal parts. All of a sudden release another album, which is all electric and loud and alternative rocky and stuff. And like their original fans were just like, but you're not the same anymore.
Right.
Like, so what?
They same thing up, happened they, to people who loved the Black Eyed Peas before Fergie.
That's true. That is true. They had some brilliant music before Fergie showed up. Then
they have some hidden gems on those albums.
That is true. Don't Lie is actually a really good song for me.
I mean, My Humps is still terrible.
Oh, yeah, still
it's
a horrible
still really
song.
A terrible song. And I'm not blaming just Fergie for this.
No.
I'm just saying that that's a reference.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
But My Humps is actually just such a bad song. And so it's...
We actually didn't even get to the point. We just talked about the Newport Pop Festival.
Yes.
We didn't say anything. But the Newport Pop Festival happened in 1968, of course, featuring Jefferson Airplane, The Grateful Dead, and The Animals. Mm-hmm.
That's why I was saying I've never heard of it. I never heard of the Newport Pop Festival.
Yes.
Right.
So it's the Newport Festival. It's, you know, but yeah, they just kept sort of changing it over the years and all of that. But it's still, you know, it's a great thing in music history because at the Newport Festival is where Dylan went electric.
Yeah.
So, and actually, if I remember looking at like a bunch of these music history things, like, all throughout these couple of weeks, it's all like, you know, so-and-so played at the Newport Pop Festival this year. So-and-so played at the Newport Jazz Festival this year. So-and-so played at the... And it's like, there's just a ton of music history.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's all just, these people played at the Newport Festival. So...
Okay, that makes more sense, because when I looked this up, it was like, this was the first time the audience topped over 100,000. And I'm going like, it also says it's the first Pop Festival. And they're... Okay.
Yep. So
I gotcha. It replace the Jazz Fest. I got
yes.
you.
Yes. So gotcha. there's a bunch of, it's all the Newport Festival, yes. but the Newport Festival like spanned many, many years
yeah.
and like was always a big to do yes. every year. So
I've heard a lot of those early jazz sessions played on KDHX.
All right. So I don't know what this next one means.
No, you don't.
So you're going to have to.
I have to do it because 1971, you can't play with my yo-yo, Brian.
That's a song?
I put your name at the end of it.
Oh, I was going to say, why have I not right. heard of this song?
Yolanda.
Like, that's very specific. You can't play with
no,
my yo-yo,
the
Brian.
Song is called Can't Play With My Yo-Yo. It's by the rapper Yo-Yo, who was born on this day in 1971, Yolanda Whitaker. In L.A.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And Yo-Yo has got some good stuff, right? Like her first album, Make Way for the Motherlode,
mm-hmm.
is a good album. So thanks, Ice Cube, for like bringing Yo-Yo to the world.
All right. Let's jump on to the next year, 1972. Yes.
I know you're going to have something to say about this.
Superfly is released in theaters. And the world gets to hear what Curtis Mayfield has been working on.
Yes, they do, because that soundtrack is outstanding.
Yeah, it is.
It's Curtis Mayfield's best work.
Yep.
Which, I mean, not that Superfly is a bad movie, right? But it's over the top and hammy.
Yes.
So to have really heartfelt, gut-wrenching songs
mm-hmm.
just come out of it is, for me, it's in contrast to what the feel of the film is.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree, but I don't really have anything else to add to that. I'm sorry.
Oh, all right, then. Let's get to the next one.
Let's go to 1984. Prince started a 24-week run at the top of the U.S. album charts with Purple Rain,
mm-hmm.
Purple Rain. And, yeah, it's his sixth studio album, though, which featured all the freaking hits
yes.
like from back in the day, When Doves Cry and Let's Go Crazy. As well as the title track, which sold over 20 million copies worldwide, becoming the seventh best-selling album of all time.
Mind blown.
Prince. That, back in that day,
mm-hmm.
a man could do no wrong. He
yeah.
just made brilliant music once. And of course, you know, he made some really great music videos too. Like... But yeah, back in that day, of course, Purple Rain is like one of those movies that people mm-hmm. just have to watch, even though it's like really bad.
Nine tracks on Purple Rain. Nine tracks.
Yeah.
And only two of these weren't singles.
Yeah.
Only two of them weren't. Let's Go Crazy, of course, was one. Darling Nikki was one.
Mm-hmm.
I think The Beautiful Ones was.
I want to say, right.
But Computer Blue and... I would die for you. I don't know if that was one or not.
I would die for
yeah, that,
you.
I think that was. Take Me With You, though.
Yeah.
I don't think it was.
I don't.
So Computer Blue and Take Me With You.
Yeah, I don't remember those.
Two out of nine tracks.
Yep.
Seven tracks, all singles.
Yep.
Huge singles, yeah.
But yeah, When Doves Cry is a great song. I still, that to this day is one of my mm-hmm. favorite Prince songs.
I can't stand it. It's been ruined for me by like one guy singing drunk karaoke at a bar.
Oh. See, I always thought it was great because like the first time I ever remember really listening to it
yeah.
was with the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack when that kid in the choir sings it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's a really good song. I want to go back and listen to that again. So I did. And it was like, oh my, that's a really good song. So there you go. But we got one more mm-hmm. little fact. For the evening, Jake, close us out.
I would love to. 1994, Biggie Smalls weds Faith Evans.
Okay.
Did you know that they were married?
I had no idea.
Yeah. Faith Evans, really big artist.
Yeah.
Great voice. She was married to Biggie Smalls in 1994. They had met at a photo shoot for Bad Boys Records. And they were married 5 days before Biggie's first single was released, Juicy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So then later, of course, his LP came out in that September, which completely changed the rap game.
You know it's bad.
What's that?
I'm so horrible.
What's that?
You said Faith Evans.
Yes.
And of course, the first thing that pops into my head is Faith Hill.
Oh, no. Completely different person.
And so I was like, wait, hold on. And then it's like, it's like, there's no way that's right. And so then I had to go back and look at it and be like, okay, yes. This makes a lot more sense now. It's like Biggie didn't marry the country superstar Faith Hill.
No.
That would have been a great wedding, though.
It would have been. But hey, he married.
Cowboy hats on the right.
Plaid button ups and durags on the left. Yeah.
Oh, it would have been a brilliant wedding.
Yeah, you would have plaid on both sides, I guess.
Greatest
really,
collaboration but... of all time.
But no, hey, Faith Evans.
Faith Evans, yes. Now I was looking at the songs and stuff, and so, mm-hmm. But for some reason, I remember Faith Evans, Faith Hill.
Yes.
And all of that. So, yeah.
Okay. No. She teamed up with Missy Misdemeanor Elliott a lot. Not whoever Faith Hill teams up with. I have no idea.
This is gonna be
a running theme now on the show, isn't it? I can't tell Chubby Checker and Fast Domino apart. You can't tell
Faith Evans from Faith Hill. Oh man, that's great though. Either way, folks, that's all we got for the music history bits. I know, of course, we went as long as we usually do, which is about an hour and a half right now. So, of course, yeah, if you want to talk about any of the things that we brought up on this show, find us on social media. You can go to our group at Follow the Sound. I'm always trying to get something posted on there or get my friends to post other things on there. Come on there and say, hey, Brian, you're stupid about this one particular fact. I will gladly have that conversation with you. And if you want to find us on Twitter, you can find us at IFollowTheSound. And of course, I will also talk to you there too, because why not? Or Jake will. I mean, Jake's got access to the exact same stuff I got access to. So he can talk to you too. You might want to talk to him a little bit more because he's more fun than me. But if you want to help out the show financially, you can go to our website and click on the Amazon banner and then go do all of your normal shopping. You've heard me say this before. And then we get a little bit of money back. It's a very simple thing to do, and you don't have to really do anything else. It doesn't cost you anything extra. So please go and help us out. Also, if you like the show, please, go on the page, like our Facebook page, share the show with your friends. Invite your friends to join our group, because we want to be a community that actually discusses this great thing that we love called music. And so, invite your friends. Let's have a great conversation about this stuff. But I have been your host, Brian Kroc. And of course, along with me has been my co-host, Jacob Crum.
I'm not ashamed to say, I always hope to be this way. Thank you for being a friend, Brian.
Thank you, Jake. Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.